Longhorn Nation. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Texas is the foot kicker. The kicker comes through.
We're back. Hello and welcome back to another very special episode of Fire Tom Herman, your overreactionary Texas football fan podcast. I'm Josh, and I'm here with Noah to discuss the big news for Texas football over the past week or so since our last episode. I think it's been about that long. But Tom Herman finally made a decision about our next defensive coordinator, and the early signing period began. So we officially have 16 new members of the Longhorns football program.
Yeah, and there's some good ones. You know, the class has taken a couple hits over the last couple months, really since our season started going south in October. But overall, it's a pretty strong class, a lot of studs, and I think that we're going to be able to finish it out like reasonably well over the next couple months as we put the finishing touches on it.
Yeah, as we come back up to National Signing Day 2, hopefully we're able to take advantage of whoever we end up with on this new staff, see who our new DC hires, whoever our new OC ends up being. The guys that he puts in place, we'll see what we can finish the year with. But first of all, the new defensive coordinator is the former head coach at Rutgers. He was fired this year from being a head coach. He has a good lineage, won a national championship as the defensive coordinator, counterpart to Tom Herman being the offensive coordinator in 2014 at Ohio State. Chris Ass is the new defensive coordinator. So what do you think? What are your first reactions to having him come on board?
Okay, well, my first reaction was actually kind of negative. And I think that that just kind of stems from the whole comfort hire aspect of it. And I think that this has been discussed a lot, and a lot of people are probably tired about hearing about it. You know, this is just another thing where Herman didn't really go outside his circle. It doesn't really seem like there was, like, now that the smoke is clear, it doesn't seem like there was a real search process done. There are rumors that maybe we talked to Morgan Scally and Barry Odom, but it's also never been reported that he interviewed anybody else. So I think that that's kind of the issue that I had with Ash originally, is just that Herman didn't seem to take the process as seriously as he should have. And maybe seriously isn't the right word, but he didn't really go through the process in the way that I was hoping that he would. But Chris Ash, like, just stand alone aside from that, I think is fine. Pretty solid hire.
Yeah, I mean, by pedigree, his ability to actually coach up a defense, the improvements that Ohio State saw from 2013 to 2014 when he came on board, gives you, I think, some confidence, at least in his ability to sort of simplify and let the athletes be athletes. And that's what I really think this defense needs. You had a lot of young guys this year who have gotten a lot of experience. Now you need to be able to give them the chance to take that experience and really make the most of it without overcomplicating things. So it'll be interesting, but I think the biggest thing is that there is going to be sort of a scheme change, or at least Chris Ass's scheme at Ohio State has differed, or was quite different from what we had with Todd Orlando. You're better at sort of breaking down the scheme stuff, so sort of get me in. What's the difference? What did he do at Ohio State that's different from what Todd Orlando did?
So the big thing that has some parts of our fan base excited is that Chris Ash traditionally runs a four-man front rather than a three-man, like three down linemen front that Orlando used. I don't think it really matters because it really doesn't. You can succeed with either of them. Like, Baylor just put up the best defense in the Big 12 with a three-man front. I think Iowa State has used one for a couple of years now. LSU runs one. I'm pretty sure Alabama primarily uses the three-man front. But Ash likes the four-man, which is fine. And for me, that's really interesting because it means there's going to be a lot of adjustment going on in the front seven, because that's who, like, that part of the defense will primarily affect. So a bunch of guys are going to have to adjust and learn new positions. So in my mind, I think that there are some guys that are going to be helped by that. For example, Marquez Bimage looked a lot better in the Tech game whenever we used some more like four-man down fronts. Ojomo, I think, fits a little bit better with a four-man. But the guys that I kind of view with question marks, I kind of have like three categories of them. The first are two new linemen, which will be Joseph Osai, who was like the outside linebacker, but he's probably going to have to spin down to a defensive end in this, and Keandre Coburn. Both of those guys I don't think are going to have any issue. It's just going to be like a new learning experience. But they should both be fine and both be really solid players once they kind of adjust, because Coburn's going to have to lose some weight, whereas Osai's going to have to put some on. And then I kind of have a second category of guys, which are in the secondary. So that's BJ Foster, DeMarvin Overshown, and Tyler Owens. And those guys are all going to have to learn a more traditional spot because they're more hybrid players, which is kind of the same case for Joseph Osai. But there's less room for hybrid players to succeed in a four-man front because of the fact that you're taking, like, typically that hybrid guy that we've used with a three-man front is a replacement for one of the down linemen. So now that we're putting that lineman back in, we're going to have to take one of them off the field. So that kind of eliminates that hybrid spot. Like, you can still use a big nickel or something similar. Like, with four down linemen, it's just a little bit less commonplace, I guess. It's a little bit more rare. So we'll see how those guys adjust. And then lastly, I think that you'll see some of the young guys or backups like Byron Bonds or Prince Dorba also have to kind of, like, either they're now playing for a scheme that they weren't recruited to originally, or they're having to relearn something kind of in the same vein that Osai was.
Yeah, and the thing that'll make it interesting is sort of the press conference, the questions, I guess. I think it was on ESPN, actually. ESPN2, Tom Herman was on. Where he was being asked about the hire, and I think just sort of discussing, because the media is well aware of these sort of scheme differences that have been noted between Todd Orlando's three-man front, Chris Ass's traditional four-man, is how well the players are going to fit this scheme. And Herman said it's irrelevant. Your job is to make the scheme fit the players that you have. So it'll be interesting to see how much of what we saw from 2014 Ohio State and Rutgers for the last 4 years, what that looks like at Texas, or how much it gets adapted to fit a scheme where we have been recruiting for a three-man front. Because like you talked about, those hybrid guys, those tweeners, where you had Joseph Osai, Byron Vaughns, Prince Dorba, those guys were all set up to be that tweener where you're not big enough to be a defensive end, but you're a little too big to just play pure linebacker. We had that B-backer spot. Then with the guys like Foster and Overshown and Owens, those are guys who are too big to be safety, but a little too small to be the linebacker. So that's where you had our rover position. It'll be interesting, you're right, to see how those guys adapt or how Chris Ass adapts to them.
I get where Herman is coming from in that it is his job to coach these guys up. I think he's also right in that these guys are capable of being coached up, right? Like, if we do a good job next year, all these guys should be fine. But I also wouldn't necessarily say it's irrelevant, because I think Coburn is like the perfect fit for a nose guard. He's going to need to probably lose like 30 or 40 pounds in order to play defensive tackle for a 4-2 or 4-2-5 or 4-3, which is just a big adjustment. And it's one I think that he'll be able to make. Like, sometimes guys are just a perfect fit for something, and it's just a little bit unfortunate that they're having to be moved from that spot where they really were kind of in the perfect scenario to succeed originally.
Absolutely. And I a lot of this will come down to that staff that gets hired. As of right now, no one else on the defense other than Todd Orlando was let go. So Craig Nivar is still there for safeties. Jason Washington is still there for cornerbacks. And you've still got Oscar Giles at defensive line. We'll see how Chris Ass approaches that, whether those guys are retained or if we're making new hires. In the event that we are making new hires, I know a name that pops up a lot, especially on the defensive line, is Frank Okam up there at Baylor. He's a UT alum. Anyone who's not a Zoomer, basically, who's listening to this podcast, probably recognizes that name. So I think that would be a great place to start, because the thing that made Baylor play so well defensively this past year was because they were able to create havoc with only three down linemen.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, James Lynch is just like a really good player, and really, I mean, he kind of blew up a lot of what we were wanting to do on offense just by himself. And so a big part of that has to be coaching, because, I mean, these are guys that aren't highly recruited prospects. They weren't highly ranked, and they're coming in and just tearing up the Big 12, a conference known for its offense. So I definitely think Okam would be a great option, because I do expect that I shouldn't say I expect, but generally a lot of staffs around the country, defensive staffs, you know, the ones that actually have five defensive coaches rather than four like we have for the last couple of years, will have two defensive line coaches, one linebacker, and two DB coaches. So I think that we'll see, I'm hoping we'll see another defensive line coach brought on. And the other guy I would actually look at is the SMU defensive line coach, Randall Joyner, because I know that he is like young and up and coming and everything. So he might be another guy that gets looked. And then hopefully Ash has like a solid network of guys that he can like bring in as candidates. But I can't really speak to what his network is actually like.
Another thing that'll be interesting to follow is Herman has sort of said in the past, he values recruiting extremely highly. It's probably the number one thing that he looks for in his coaches is their ability to recruit and then their ability to develop. So it'll be interesting to see where that balance is, because a lot of our problems this past year weren't because we had bad recruiting. We had a lot of good players, a lot of individual talent. We just were failing to develop them and we were failing to get them to play together as a unit. So we'll see where that balance falls, especially if we are rebalancing the staff. It'll be interesting to see where we end up there. So I think that's what's really going to make or break this next season, especially on the defensive side, is where we put our priority there. If we do focus on guys who can develop our players, I think we'll be all right. It'll get Herman to another year, which, depending on your perspective, is either a good or bad thing. And despite the name of the podcast, I think both of us would agree that we'd rather be successful and keep Herman than tank a season just to get rid of him. I don't think either of us is at that point where we're just ready for him to be just completely gone and have sort of written him off.
I'm definitely not. I still actually think that I'm a little bit higher on Herman than most people, or at least higher than most of the vocal parts of the Texas fan base, just because I think Herman has a lot of things going for him. Like, I think that as much as we get tired of his platitudes about being physical and about running the ball and establishing the run and playing just like really sound football, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And that goes a long way towards being successful. I mean, I also don't think that you just fluke your way to two New Year's Six bowl wins at two different programs. I think that you have to at least have the capability of being a good coach in order to do that. Like, I don't think that Herman is a bad coach that just happened to be highly successful for three out of his first 4 years. I just think he had a really bad year.
Like, once can be sort of the outlier, like you had with Charlie Strong getting Louisville to the Sugar Bowl or whatever it was, or the Orange Bowl, whichever one it was, against Florida. You can't, like, you can look at that and go, okay, that's Teddy Bridgewater carried him there, and he owes everything to Teddy Bridgewater. But now you have it, yeah, two different programs, two different starting points, two different opponents that you played.
Two different quarterbacks.
Two different circumstances to get you there. I mean, you had good quarterbacks, yeah, but I mean, again, what are the chances that a guy who's supposedly, if you're making the argument that Herman is a bad coach, what are the chances that a guy who's as bad a coach as Herman is supposed to be manages to put those pieces together to make those quarterbacks successful? And I guess that really remains to be seen. That's what we're going to find out next year, now that we've really had to, now that Herman's really been tested for the first time as a head coach with staff turnover. We'll see what choices he makes to see if we can take advantage. Because I think the best news is that our last three defensive coordinators have been really fucking good season one. Manny Diaz in 2011, awesome. Vance Bedford in 2014, awesome. Todd Orlando in 2017, awesome. And then they sucked afterwards. So if we can just take advantage, even if that's the pattern we're going to follow forever, if we can just take advantage of that for Sam's senior year and put together a special season, that would be great.
Definitely would be. And then the last thing I would kind of point to in Herman's defense here is this is just something that I personally really look to as an indicator of like a coach's quality, is his bowl record. I mean, knock on wood, this might not be true in 2 weeks, but as of right now, I'm pretty sure he's undefeated in bowl games, right? And so I think that speaks to his ability to prepare and develop his team. Because, I mean, theoretically, you're getting matched up with an even opponent. And so we'll see how we do against Utah here in a couple weeks, but I do like that about Herman, that he's been able to, in the past, do the self-evaluation, everything needed. Like last year, he did a lot of scouting on our tendencies on offense and was able to mask them going into the Georgia game. But that's also a little bit puzzling because he did such a poor job of that throughout the season this year. So I don't really know what to make of that, but I still look at it as a positive data point.
Yeah, we'll see what comes out of it. The other big news, we are recording Wednesday night, so this is National Signing Day, the very first National Signing Day. I guess technically it's a three-day-long signing period. But really, if you were planning on signing during this early signing period, you did it this morning, or in the state of Arizona's case, in the late afternoon. But we got 16 new members, and we're just going to run through them. We're not going to linger too much because neither one of us is going to pretend to be someone who's got a good eye for high school talent. But we'll just sort of run through the guys that we do like. And we'll start off with the QBs. We got two QBs in this class, both of them extremely highly rated, both of them extremely athletic. Both of them are true dual threat quarterbacks, but out of different molds. You've got Hudson Card, and then you've got Jaquindon Jackson. Card is sort of that tall, lanky, pass first kind of guy, but he played wide receiver up until his sophomore year in high school. So he's got quick twitch athleticism. He's fast. And then you've got Jaquindon Jackson, who, as much as you don't want to sort of overstate his athleticism, when you watch him play quarterback, it reminds you a lot of watching Cam Newton when he was with Auburn in 2010.
Yep, they're both similar but different. But I think that they're both like really quality takes. It should be a fun battle to watch. Hopefully we don't end up with one transferring out after their freshman year like Cam Rising did. But I think it's always good to have competition in the QB room. I think that you always just take as many quality quarterbacks as you get, and then you expect that some of them will transfer down the line. These two guys at least are athletic enough that they can play other positions. You know, like there's prior to this last spring, there was talk about Jaquindon maybe being a linebacker. Card, like you said, played receiver for 2 years in high school and was pretty good at it. So there's always a chance that those guys might just opt to change positions, although that's certainly not a given and not something that we should take for granted.
Yeah, especially nowadays, it's hard with the transfer portal to really just expect that a guy is going to stick around if he really wants to play quarterback. But it's nice that we leave that door open. We don't have, like when we brought in Cam Rising and Casey Thompson, they were quarterbacks, or there really wasn't another spot that you were expecting to move them to. So we've got two guys who can be moved, so we at least give ourselves that option, so there is something of a chance when one of those guys loses the QB battle, that he doesn't immediately take off. Next up, going through the defensive backs, we've got Keaton Crawford, Jaron Thompson, and Xavion Alford. I know Crawford's pretty fast. Jaron Thompson looks like a guy who's going to be a nickel for us. Xavion Alford's going to be a safety, but I think probably the most notable thing here, Xavion Alford's got the best nickname, I think, of anyone in this entire class, being the 100-yard landlord.
For the longest time, whenever I saw that nickname, like on his Twitter and stuff, I always read it as the 100-yard lanyard, and I just had like no idea what it meant. Like I thought it was just like the worst nickname ever. Like, what does lanyards have to do with football? And then one day it kind of clicked, and I was like, oh, landlord. Like, oh, that's pretty sick. Like, that's clever for a safety.
I'm a little nervous to ask you how long it took. Like, what was the time gap between when you first saw it thinking it was lanyard to when you resolved it?
Okay, I'm trying to think. I think I realized sometime, like, right leading up to his commitment, like in the fall, I think that's when it kind of hit me. I can't remember exactly when he committed, but I think it was, like, sometime, like, fairly close to his commitment date. So I guess like in the spring or something I saw it. It's not like I was like on his Twitter like every day looking at 100-yard lanyard.
Yeah, if it was before he committed, you weren't thinking too much about it. So yeah, probably about the time that our Discord was going wild just making ridiculous memes for all of our commitments. Probably sounds like about the time when you would have caught on to it. Next up, we got the O-line class. We got Jalen Garth, Logan Parr, Jake Majors, and Andre Carrick?
I think it's Andre.
Andre Carrick. See, they throw in a J there. It's not an I or anything. It's not obvious. I clearly am not great. I think he's got Eastern European heritage.
I don't know either, but I always read it as Andre.
Yeah, we're probably pronouncing that wrong. Sorry if for some reason you're a player listening to this. Don't you have something better to do? But sorry for pronouncing your name wrong. But those four, I think, make up a pretty good O-line class. We've got Jake Majors, who probably projects to being a center. Logan Parr, going to be another interior guy. I think Carrick is the most true tackle of the four. But a guy like Jalen Garth, I think, is one of those guys who can end up being the swing player like we have with Derek Kerstetter this past season, where he could be inside or outside. Just depends on what the team needs. So we don't have a ton of flash. We don't have that one like five star that you like think of, like with 2021, you've got Tommy Brockermeyer being sort of the focus of your O-line recruiting. We don't have that one guy who's going to have that name recognition, but I think all four of these guys have the potential to be solid players for us.
Yeah. And I think that, I think they might've had a little bit more attention if they hadn't like committed so early in the case of Parr and Majors. And then Garth even, I mean, he hasn't played his senior year, so we'll have to see how his recovery goes. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're all good. I like all of them. I will say that Karich had, I saw that recently he was named like, all right, this is what it is. It's the 2020 Anthony Munoz Lineman of the Year Award for the All-American Bowl. And the other two offensive linemen that were there were Paris Johnson and Peter Skoronski, who are like five stars and like high four stars. And the other guy's Brian Brees, who's a five star. So that's pretty lofty company to be included in there. So I think that he's got a great ceiling. It's a really good line class overall. And yeah, I'm definitely happy to have them because, I mean, Lord knows you always need quality offensive linemen.
I sort of think as a general rule of thumb, you're always aiming to basically have an entire full new line come in every year and just hoping something sticks, because it's really a numbers game. You cannot sacrifice depth in the trenches. You cannot have too many.
Right. We never want to be back in that spot where we couldn't have a two deep for the spring game like we did, I think, yeah, 2017.
Or where we're playing freshmen not because they're good, but because we don't have an option to not play them.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to avoid. But yeah, and then on the other side of the trenches, we had two defensive linemen sign for this early signing day, and we're still doing some work for National Signing Day too. But we had Sawyer Gorham Welch, who just recently, I think in the last week, flipped to us from Oklahoma State. And then I think really the big prize, one of the guys who was the focus during the spring and summer for recruiting really came around, was Vernon Broughton. Big battle with A&M, few other suitors, but it really came down to us versus A&M. And as Aggies do, they were trying to peddle rumors that he was looking to flip right before National Signing Day. He was about as stress-free as it comes on National Signing Day. Signed to Texas. Had a big old sign behind him. I saw a picture of his signing ceremony. His banner behind him was like a fantasy, sort of like a fan cover, like he was going to be the cover athlete for NCAA Football 20. Please, EA, bring this back. But I mean, never a doubt, at least in my mind, that he was coming to Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely never had a doubt about Vernon Broughton at
never.
Any point in his recruitment.
I knew from the start that
you
he was coming
no
to Texas.
Bamboozle.
At, yeah, zero bamboozles. There was nothing that could ever stress anyone out for this.
But yeah, no, I mean, I love Broughton. I think that he's a massive get. Like, I have him in, I don't know, probably the top three in the class of guys that I wanted to land. And then Sawyer Gorham Welch, I mean, he's new. Don't know that much about him. We just picked him up, like, really recently after we lost Van. But yeah, I mean, it's a good start for the class, but it's definitely, we're going to need to fill out that defensive line room a little bit more by next signing day.
Yeah, get at least one more guy in there. And here, once we finish up our list, we'll talk about some guys that we're targeting there. And again, we're not recruiting reporters, so we're not going to give you some insider info. It's just the names we know that are still in the mix for National Signing Day.
I mean, I can tell
day
people
too.
That we're going to end up landing everybody.
I mean, everyone already knows that Jalen Waddle is going to be here. He'll be transferring from Alabama. Any day now, that'll pop up in the portal. Brew McCoy probably on his way back
too.
You just
wanted them to get some non-Maringer years in of coaching, you know?
Yeah,
like some actual coaching
get coached up by some real coaches.
Yeah, so then we get them back at their peak.
Yeah, it'll be great. Next for our guys, had two linebackers. Technically, one of these guys is an athlete, but for all intents and purposes, it sounds like he's projecting the linebacker. We got Jaden Hullaby and Prince Dorba. And honestly, Prince Dorba, sort of wasn't exactly sure what to call him because he was recruited to fit into Todd Orlando's scheme. He was sort of a natural B-backer. So we'll see where he really ends up being part of Chris S's scheme.
I think he'll end up at a weak defensive end spot for us because I know that he plays, I'm pretty sure he plays with a hand down at Highland Park. So I don't see him moving from defensive line to linebacker. I might be wrong on that, but I think that's where he'll end up. And then Hullaby, yeah, not sure what to make of him because I've also seen talk about like the tight end or H-back spot for him. So we'll just kind of see. But he's one of those guys that's been flying under the radar. He's been solid all along. He was happy to jump on the Texas offer. So I think that he's a guy that could surprise later on.
Yeah, he fits sort of that image I have in my head of guys that are part of the class, don't get a ton of fanfare, and then in like a year or two after a redshirt year or something, he's popping up as a guy who's pushing for playing time and ends up getting starts by the end of his like redshirt sophomore year, and just ends up being a solid contributor. If he, even if he's not the like the greatest player on the field, he's just a one of those reliable guys. I could see that being Holaby from this class.
Yeah, and we've actually had, so I mean, this is another thing that Herman is good at, and I want to give him a lot of credit for, is like the staff has done a pretty good job with evaluations and with picking up some of these like lowly rated guys. We've had success with Cosme is probably the most notable. Juwan Mitchell last year was a late take, you know. But these guys that have come in and have actually contributed fairly early, even in their career, maybe not like right away, but within a couple of years, they've gotten to the point where we're starting to see what the coaches saw originally whenever they made the offer.
Yeah, and I think that'll really come to a head, especially on the offensive line. If you guys remember from last year, Herb Hand did a sort of an interview conversation with a, I don't know if it was Texas Football Monthly or what, whoever it was, but just talking about sort of his evaluation practice is not so much to look for a guy who's got all the technical stuff down already, because you can coach that into a guy, but he's looking for a guy with a high motor, good work ethic, really the right attitude about playing offensive line, because that's not something you just coach into a guy. And as a result, sort of talked about how it is hard, especially for recruiting services, to really accurately reflect the quality of an offensive line recruit, because there's so much that can happen. Even just taking a kid from a high school weight program to a college weight program, you could get a completely different player. A three-star guy like a Sam Cosme or like a Christian Jones, who's probably going to be pushing for playing time in the next few years. Those guys go from being effectively nobodies to potentially, like in Cosme's case, the anchor of your line, all because he was a three-star, so he didn't get the fanfare. So that is one thing I agree that this staff has done really well. Next up, talk about the wide receivers we got. Biggest name is going to be Troy Omer. He is the first, I believe, first player to flip between Texas A&M and Texas, but do like a clean flip. I believe since, was it like Otaro Alaka in like the 2014 class or something like
it's
that?
It's been a while.
It's been a long time. For all the hype that the A&M versus Texas recruiting battles come to, usually once a kid makes a decision between those two schools, he's not switching back to the other one. So pretty rare thing. He's a big guy, kind of pretty well documented by a lot of Texas fans, especially on Surly. He's not exactly the fastest guy, but we've shown with guys like Lil Jordan Humphrey that there are ways to be successful.
Malcolm Epps, oh my God.
Yeah, there are ways to be successful in this offense without having to have wheels. So it'll be interesting to see his development. If he's got good hands, he can definitely still make an impact with this offense. And then we've also got Dejon Harrison, another guy, three-star recruit, where we'll be seeing exactly what he's able to bring to the table.
Yep, and I don't really have much of a comment on these guys, though I do want to give a shout-out to, I think, I'm pretty sure it was in Herman's press conference today, he was talking about Omire. That's how I've always pronounced it in my head, Omire. But he was talking to his mother, and after flipping to Texas, she was like, oh, he's finally smiling again. I'm just like, okay.
Really, you sort of look at that story, and it kind of reminds you, like, in the late 80s, where, like, CBS or something would do some big report about the differences between the United States and the Soviet Union. They'd bring people over from the Soviet Union who would just basically break down in tears in a grocery store at seeing how much better it could be. And that's probably, like, those examples are probably just a lesser version of what Troy was feeling going from A&M to Texas.
Yeah. It's comparable, but there's nothing quite like that A&M to Texas jump.
Yeah. Like, really, if you get right down to it, Soviet defectors kind of had it easy. Yeah.
And I think anybody that's ever been on the A&M campus knows and looked around and has, you know, vision would definitely agree with that.
Yeah. I'm 100% sure. I don't think they've done the Golden Globes yet, but I believe if Chernobyl wins a Golden Globe, I believe it'll be Texas A&M's first Golden Globe win for being the set piece, playing Pripyat. So
yeah, it's okay. You know what? We can move on from the A&M slander.
There are never too many A&M jokes, but that's fine. The last member of the class is going to be the big one, the 5-star, the one that had people wringing their hands because in Arizona, they were at Sal Point Catholic High School. They were not doing their signing ceremony. until 1:30 Central Time. So, yeah, Bijan Robinson. There was a whole lot of hand-wringing about whether or not we were going to get him to commit in the first place. Then we got him on board. Then the season went sideways. Then there was concern that he was going to flip to USC or back to Ohio State, which he had silently done before publicly committing to Texas. So, I mean, there was a lot of concern around him, and I think there were a lot of insiders for other programs that were trying to peddle some drama. And it seemed like Bijan had sort of re-solidified in the past few weeks. But end result, Stan Drayton finally gets one of his guys that he targeted more or less from the beginning, was his priority throughout his recruiting cycle. But a guy with like game-breaking speed and true video game numbers. I think he's averaging something ridiculous like 20 or 30 yards per carry, which can sort of get blown off as Arizona high school competition. But, I mean, he could be... He's the first five-star Texas has signed as a running back since Jonathan Gray. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a lot like Jake Smith last year, where their numbers are just like stupid. And like they are playing a low level of competition, but... Whenever you're looking at a guy that doesn't play great competition, you just look for them to dominate that competition. And Bijan has done that and more. So I mean, yeah, his numbers are crazy. I am super excited about him. He seems like a really great kid, like really high character. I'm just like everybody else in the Texas fan base, I'm so happy to have him coming to the 40 Acres. He's the only five-star that signed today in the entire Big 12. So he's the type of guy that you can look to be a program changer, because that's what five stars means, really. So, yeah, I don't know if there's enough good things to say about Bijan.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes on and on. If you haven't, you definitely got to go back and look through some of his quotes after he committed. It's just where his priorities were, why he liked Texas, why he felt at home at Texas, why he connected with Stan Drayton. And, yeah, it's definitely... strikes you as a kid who's not just in it for the glory or whatever. It's there's a lot to it that goes into these decisions, and I think that's something that a lot of people lose sight of, really, for all recruits. A lot of fans like to simplify it to a wins and losses thing, but how much of an impact is the culture of the program, the school, the city, their relationship with coaches and the people around them, how important that all is to the process, how it truly can be more than just football success that pulls a kid in.
Right. Like I saw a story where after game he got left like at the visiting stadium. He didn't make the bus. The bus left him because he was like signing autographs for kids after the game. So I don't know. Upstanding kid. Happy to have him. Great for the culture and should be a monster on the field as well.
Yeah. Brings a lot to that running back room next year.
Which, yeah, low key
to have him in there.
Like really stacked for us. If we keep Whittington and Sean Johnson there.
Yeah, between having him as a freshman, you're going to have a junior, Keontae Ingram. Remains to be seen what Roshan Johnson does, where Jordan Whittington ends up, just depending on how this roster shifts around a little bit in the offseason. Yeah, that running back room goes from basically being a nightmare scene in week two this season to possibly being a strength as long as everyone remains healthy. So, we'll see how it goes. I'm definitely excited to see Bijan Robinson. Unfortunately, we're going to have to wait until the fall. We won't get to see him in the spring game because Arizona high schools aren't really conducive to early graduation. So he won't be an early enrollee. The guys that we got in this class for National Signing Day 1 who will be early enrolling, going to be quarterback Hudson Card, defensive backs Xavion Alford and Jaron Thompson, offensive linemen Logan Parr and Jake Majors, both the defensive linemen, Sawyer Gorham Welch and Vernon Broughton, as well as wide receiver Troy O'Meara. I don't know. Bad at pronunciations, but that's what it boils down to. But for National Signing Day 2, I think there's really four guys that we need to focus on moving forward.
Yep, and those we have listed here are Alfred Collins, defensive lineman, another defensive lineman, Princely, Uman Mielen, Kelvonte Dixon, who's kind of an athlete, probably their wide receiver, defensive back. And then, I mean, we have him on here because I think you have to talk about him, but Keely Ringo, who, I don't think that one's happening.
I mean, that one's a long shot. I think if you're putting it in most likely to least likely, it's probably Dixon, I think, is going to be your most likely just because I think we have a need. We can take one more wide receiver in this class with only two, and he fits that mold where he can be sort of be a playmaker as a wide receiver. Plus, he is also Keontae Ingram's brother, so we have an in there. I would say that one's the most likely. It would probably surprise me more if he didn't end up coming to Texas. From there, second and third, I think they're both sort of tied together for me. It's going to be both those defensive linemen. Collins is a UT legacy. Princely was committed, so he'd have to pull off the generally pretty rare decommit, recommit. But it sounds like things could be going all right there. But yeah, Kelly Ringo definitely kind of a pipe dream, I'll be honest. But he's been a guy that we've been on for so long. He spent a week taking in spring practice for us this past spring on his own dime. So you want to leave that door open for a guy who has the potential that Kelly Ringo has.
Right. We'll keep recruiting him. But, I don't know. Maybe Oregon and Georgia will both be stuck with death penalties between now and February. But otherwise, I think it's pretty far long shot there. And then I'm also sure there's going to be more names that pop up. We're going to have to take more linebackers. It wouldn't surprise me to see another defensive back pop up, maybe, depending on how they view like DeJuan Harrison and Kevontae Dixon, like another cornerback specifically. And then also, I think we'll probably at least try to get a second running back in this class. We had Ty Jordan before his decommitment there, but I think that we'll try to do that in the event that they want to move Whittington or that Rashawn wants to move back to quarterback.
Yeah, and this is that time of year where you do start really seeing JUCO names pop up. So it'll be interesting to see how those efforts move forward. So I think Herman said they're going to look for 5 to 6 more guys to fill out this class before February. And if they can find the right 5 or 6 guys, it will have scholarships for them. So this class could end up with as many as 21, 22 people. I would be surprised if we didn't come out with anyone new by National Signing Day too. So I'd say there's probably at least one or two for sure that are going to be joining. But yeah, this will be an interesting point where you start getting into those depth guys. Most of your big names are off the board. Now you start looking for those gems that are left at the JUCO level or just guys who were overlooked because they were late developers and they're going to have all their senior film now. So that's the thing to keep an eye on going into February. But before we get to National Signing Day 2 in February, we do have a bowl game. We haven't really talked a whole lot about it, but given the holidays, how our travel schedules are going to work out, we're really not going to get a chance to talk about it much. And honestly, we're not going to talk about it that much here. We're just basically going to make some sort of off-the-cuff predictions. And I don't really know how I feel about this game, Noah.
Well, I am really excited. So I wasn't here last week. I didn't get to kind of give my reaction to it, but I think that this bowl game is about the best case scenario. Either this or Notre Dame, the Camping World Bowl, are both okay. First off, they're New Year's Eve bowls, which that's not a New Year's Six bowl, but it's at least a bowl that people have heard of and generally it's a pretty well respected bowl. And then second, Utah and Notre Dame were really the only realistic opponents that we had that would have been either a big name brand or just a really quality opponent. So I'm excited. I think that this is huge for the spring, given that in the current recruiting environment, a lot of kids make their decision in March, April, May. You want to have something to be able to pin your season on. And the highlight of our season so far is
only kind of losing to LSU.
Yeah, almost keeping up with LSU. But beating Utah, suddenly you can at least say, hey, we have a win over a team that was top 15 or that finished in the top 25.
That played for their conference title.
Yeah, a really respectable team in Utah that was, nearly in the playoffs. Plus, Utah is starting to recruit Texas more, so being able to kind of reestablish our superiority there would be great. And it lets Herman point to the fact, we took a step back this year, but we still hit 8 wins. That's at least more than my first year. It's not we completely regressed to where we were before. And then it can kind of fit into the whole if he wants to sell it this way. But we were injured and young, but with the extra bowl practices, that helped us out. So I think that this game is a big deal. I get why people are disappointed in our season. But once the season was over, this bowl was really the best case scenario for us. And I'm also excited because since it's here in Texas, I decided that I wanted to go watch the game. So I got my tickets. I'll be there in person. And hopefully I get to see my Longhorns win one last time.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how we do with the turnover on the staff. I mean, Todd Orlando being gone, I think that's not going to have a huge impact just because Craig Nivar was our co-DC this year. So having him call plays, if anything, will probably just simplify the defense just out of necessity because it'll be Nivar's first time calling plays for the defense. So I think we're going to be a lot less aggressive, which will help the defense.
Yeah, and he's a safety coach, so hopefully he understands the struggles that the safeties have had this year and will be a little bit more mindful of that in helping cover them up and help them out.
Yeah,
we don't want to go too in-depth with analysis here, but I really like our chances against Utah. I think that they have a good offense, but not an elite offense, something that isn't going to surprise us. We should be able to do well enough on defense, and their defense is really good. But I think that Oregon kind of showed that if you can control their defensive line, then you can really put up some pretty good numbers. Plus, Utah hasn't beaten an opponent with more than 7 wins this year. The only two really good teams they played to, they lost in USC and Oregon. So I'll go ahead and predict a win 38-31 or something like that.
I'm just a little skeptical of what we're going to get out of the offense with Maringer being gone, with Beck being demoted, with Meekins being demoted, with Wareheim still being on the staff. I think that gives me a lot of pause to really have faith that we're going to catch a disappointed Utah team. And I think the disappointment excuse for Utah is more valid than it was for Georgia last year. Utah went from a week ago thinking they were going to get to play for the college football playoff. They were going for beat Oregon and you're in to the Alamo Bowl. This isn't the Sugar Bowl. It's not a New Year's Six Bowl. It is still a respected bowl, being that it is on New Year's Eve, but it's not that big name flash like the Sugar Bowl where you do still care a little bit, at least a little bit. I can understand being disappointed that your season can go from college football playoff to Alamo Bowl in a matter of 60 minutes of football. So depends how Kyle Whittingham gets his team inspired, how many of their seniors stick around. But I think this is going to be the first loss for Tom Herman in a bowl game as a head coach, just because I think the staff turnover is going to be too much for us to overcome. So I'm going to say the defense will play better because of the simplification. But in general, I think the offense is just going to be a little disjointed with everything. So I'll call it 31-21 Utah. But with that, make sure to check us out on Twitter at the FTH Podcast for some shit posting between shows and instant reactions to news, especially about the coaching search and recruiting, especially in the lead up to the Alamo Bowl. At the absolute latest, you will hear from us in the wake of the bowl game against Utah to discuss the fallout from that win or loss or whatever happens. Hopefully we win. Obviously, you just heard Noah has more faith than I do. But until next time, hook 'em.